The final edition radio hour is a work of satire intended for audiences who own books, gentrify neighborhoods, and say they like kale. Please consume responsibly, the satire, that is.
Welcome to the final edition radio hour. I'm Tony Hendra.
And I'm Jeff Chrysler. Tony, what have we got this week?
Well, we lost a comedy icon a few days ago when David Brenner kicked the bucket. But luckily, we have his appearance on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson from just last night.
Oh, I miss Johnny Carson. You know, they don't make him like Johnny Carson anymore.
No, these days it's all that Piers Morgan rubbish.
Ugh, I can't stand that guy. What is Mr. Fake Accent Bad TV Show doing these days?
Oh, he's reduced to interviewing the absolute, bottom feeders. He just did an interview with the Los Angeles earthquake.
Oh, the L.A. earthquake. I forgot all about that. Huh. I thought the only news going on was this missing plane.
There's a plane missing?
Yeah, it's been on CNN all the time.
Oh, well, who watches that?
Well, somebody, not many, maybe just one guy, but I guess you're just listening to the BBC. I mean, you know, Fox is Benghazi, CNN is a missing plane. I don't even know what is on MSNBC.
Oh, actually, we have another in our continuing series of caring, sharing, deeply feeling MSNBC broadcasts.
Oh, good. It's time to care and share and feel, because spring has finally sprung, which, as you know, means just one thing.
Yes, indeed. We reveal the dark secrets of maple syrup.
Yummy. Now, you're actually a big foodie, right, Tony? Do you have any thoughts about this whole secret menu stuff going on?
Yeah, I know, but our secret menu is a secret. However, it will be revealed, but only on this week's episode of
The Final Edition Radio Hour.
The Final Edition Radio Hour is brought to you by AT&T, now introducing their new landline. The AT&T landline looks like a normal telephone, but it's much larger and comes with a cord, specially designed to plug into any standard wall socket in your home.
What a great idea. A phone that's attached to a cord that plugs right into the wall. My AT&T landline phone plugged right into a standard electrical outlet in my home. Right out of the box. No problem.
With the AT&T landline, you can make and receive as many calls as you want while sitting, standing, or wandering from room to room, depending on how long the cord is.
I love sitting on my living room couch and talking on the phone. How did they do it?
It's all in that cord. A length of insulated electrical wire that carries the telephone signal from the power lines conveniently located just outside your home. No matter where you live, bring the sound directly through the telephone receiver and right into your ear.
I'm too depressed to leave my house, so I'm home all day long. Why shouldn't I have a phone that can't leave my house either? My AT&T landline is perfect. Just like me, it's not going anywhere.
The AT&T landline, it's your lifeline.
This is MSNBC Midday, and I'm your host. I still don't have a name, but the network promised to assign me something vaguely ethnic by next year. Well, recently, Reince Priebus, chairman of the Republican Party, objected to a tweet from this network about a new Cheerios commercial. As you may recall, a previous Cheerios ad with a biracial family triggered hostile reactions from the right. The new ad has the same family, and the tweet said, quote, "Maybe the right wing will hate it, but everyone else will go, aww." We at MSNBC realized it was reckless and offensive to say right-wingers would be offended by the ad, just because right-wingers were offended by a virtually identical ad. The tweet has been pulled, the person who wrote it has been fired, the part of the building in which they wrote it has been torn down, and all the words in the tweet have been removed from our style guide. As a result, Reince Priebus agreed not to call a boycott on our network, so my first guest today is a minor Republican Party functionary whose name doesn't matter. Welcome!
Thank you for having me on your weird show.
So, now that Republicans say they're not offended by interracial marriage, and with the door open for same-sex marriage across the country, is marriage equality a dead issue?
I think the real issue is that nobody is signing up for Obamacare, no matter how many people sign up for it. The economy is in a free fall, no matter how much it isn't. Kenya, school choice, reverse discrimination, states' rights, they're coming for our guns. Benghazi, hurrah.
I see. Well, I'm glad we apologized for the tweet, or we would have missed those insights. Now, to my other guests. An MSNBC host who has had his name legally changed to Daryl trying to sound like Rachel Maddow.
Hello!
And a first-time guest, a man with a political blog named after himself, Don Jatico of the Daily Jatico.
Thanks for having me. I know this is my big shot. I'm really pumped.
They're all trying to sound like Rachel Maddow. Do you think Republicans are really giving up on the marriage issue?
Let's remember that 5 years ago, the government passed the Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, which some think of as a triumph of Keynesian macroeconomic theory, while Republicans downplay its impact on the Great Recession. We just saw unemployment rates drop in 43 U.S. states in January, and I know what you're wondering. What does this have to do with the situation in Venezuela?
Let me bring Don Jadico into the conversation. Don, is marriage equality still a hot issue?
Well, I think people are paying less attention to that, and they're worried more about the concentration of wealth in this country. I mean, think about how much power and money reside in one place. Now that your parent company, Comcast, is buying out Time Warner, it's uncomfortably close to a media monopoly. What?
Please stand by. We are experiencing technical difficulties.
We are back with our guests, Daryl, trying to sound like Rachel Maddow, and our Republican spokesman. So we get all sides of the issue. And I want to turn the subject firmly back to marriage. Isn't love a good thing? And don't you wish there was more of it? Daryl trying to sound like Rachel Maddow?
Love can actually connect all things in the universe, which is why we should stop and take a close look at a mayoral runoff election currently taking place in Seton, Pennsylvania.
And how about a Republican spokesman? Have you ever been engulfed in really intense love? The kind of love that tears you in half and gives you life and exposes your real, undignified, naked essence?
Obamacare is a failure.
We'll explore that some more after the break. This is MSNBC.
New for 2014, the Ford Dodge Chevy one-ton hump truck. Tons of power. Powers a ton. You can hump a ton. You can jump a ton. Hump at work. Hump at play.
Do not attempt this maneuver.
Hump your buddies. Hump your family.
Speed kills. Obey federal, state, and local speed limits.
Dump your buddies. Dump your family. Who needs friends and family when you got a hump truck?
In real life, throwing cars into high-speed skids causes massive head injury.
You want one. You know you want one.
No human male should be allowed to operate this vehicle.
Call your Tri-State Ford Dodge Chevy dealer now. Do it tonight.
Ford Dodge Chevy is not liable for injury or fatality purchasers of its vehicle inflicted on themselves or others. Manufacturers aware of conclusive research showing cars and trucks to be the single most stupid and lethal form of mass transportation, causing death, acute death, sudden death, soul lingering death, death by water, fire, ice, cliff, tree, and road rage, amputation, brain damage, limb loss, head loss, child loss, organ failure, quadriplegia, obesity, asthma, 48-hour terminal cancer, acute pedestrian fatality, equal Armageddon, intergalactic greenhouse gas effect, and bourgeois complacency. But manufacturers shall have no liability for the effects of operating this vehicle on or off roads, bridges, tunnels, dead ends, beaches, rivers, lakes, outside or inside malls, supermarkets, box stores, hotels, banks, restaurants, churches, temples, casinos, schools, daycare centers, or saloons.
Remember, cars don't kill people. People kill people.
Welcome to my podcast, The Foodie Network, and I'm really happy to have today's guest, Carol Spafford. She writes this awesome blog called The Secret Menu. Carol, I'm totally psyched you're here.
I am totally psyched to be here.
All right. I've been scrolling through your blog for days, and I guess, first of all, you should probably explain to people the concept of the secret menu.
Well, like, fast food restaurants have items on the menu that everybody sees,
yeah.
But there's other stuff you can order that they can serve you. If you know how to ask for it, like at the In-N-Out burger chain in California, You can actually order a triple burger or a quadruple burger, or they can put the mustard onto it while it's still cooking and grill the mustard right into it.
Uh-huh. And the only people who know this are you and your readers.
Exactly. And it's not just in and out. For example, you can go to any Chipotle and ask for a burritodilla, which is a combination of a burrito and a quesadilla, and they will know exactly what you're talking about.
Wow. And what if they don't?
Then you should demand to speak to the manager, because that is bullshit.
What about Pizza Hut? You said in your blog that if you ask for a pizza, easy over, they have to flip it in the oven when it's half done.
Yeah, and you can make them do that. And something I found out today, if you go to a Taco Bell and ask an employee to sit on your burrito, they totally will.
That's amazing. How do fast food workers react when you ask them for this stuff?
Everyone is always really impressed when you're hip to the secret menu. For instance, I was in a KFC telling them to take a mallet and break all the bones in my chicken legs. And the lady behind the counter said, "That is so cool. You are such a cool person." And she like said it over and over and over again, just like that.
That is cool. I'm talking to Carol Spafford. Check out her blog, The Secret Menu. And Carol, one last question. What is the most amazing secret menu item you found?
It turns out that you can walk into literally every restaurant in America and order a potato chip pie. Whoa. Nobody knows about this except everyone who has ever worked in a restaurant.
Well, that's hardly anybody.
Exactly.
So what's in a potato chip pie?
The last time I ordered one, I sneaked into the kitchen and watched them make it, and it turns out the secret ingredient is spit.
Uh-huh.
Coming up on the Final Edition Radio Hour, Piers Morgan interviews the Los Angeles earthquake, Johnny Carson interviews David Brenner in heaven, and we learn a little bit about how maple syrup is made from the tap sappers. Welcome back to the Final Edition Radio Hour, a more perfect onion.
Piers Morgan, and I've been cancelled. My first guest has given Los Angeles a jolt and a severe case of nerves. Please welcome the LA earthquake.
Hi, Piers.
You scored a 4.4 on the Richter scale.
And a 2.2 on the Nielsen scale.
And where does that rank you overall?
Lower than the Northridge quake, higher than NBC's Believe.
And what about your aftershocks?
Piers, the proper term is seismic spinoffs.
As a newcomer, you've gotten more media attention than bigger quakes.
Let's just say I've learned a lot from my friends, Lena and Zoe.
What's the worst part of having everybody analyze you?
The worst part is this nonsense.
Really? You mean CNN?
Not CNN. You, Piers. You're a terrible interviewer.
What do you know about me? You just got here.
Everybody knows about you. You destroy everything you touch, and they call me a natural disaster.
Huh, I didn't know seismic phenomena were so rude.
Please, you spew more vile, toxic shit than I do.
Oh, come on, you shake buildings. You threaten lives.
Most LA residents would rather be caught in one of my episodes than one of yours.
Well, so why don't you just replace me at CNN?
Oh, I'm in talks with Jeff Zucker.
The head of Facebook?
The head of CNN? The head of Facebook is Mark Zuckerberg. Are you that stupid?
I must be. I'm engaging in repartee with an obnoxious Hollywood tremblor.
Ew, good one, Piers. I'm quaking.
What was that?
Oh, nothing.
Well, I hope this is the last we've seen of you. This is Piers Morgan saying good night!
This is the story of Brian Davis, who went to the West Ridge Glove Company to fill out a job application. We begin our story in the middle.
Wake up, Mr. Davis.
Huh? Where am I?
You're still filling out our job application? You passed out during the self-evaluation survey?
Is this still Monday?
It's Thursday. Mr. Davis, how much would you agree with the following statement? I would always follow a supervisor's instructions exactly. Do you strongly disagree, disagree, feel neutral, agree, or strongly agree?
You've asked me that same question 5 different ways. We both know what answer you want to hear.
You cannot possibly know what answer I want. You can only know what's in your heart. Would you always follow a supervisor's instructions?
Yes, I strongly agree. Yes.
Good. We're almost done.
It's been 5 days. My God, I started this job application last weekend. What job is this again?
Maintenance. Now, how much would you agree with the following statement? I resent getting instructions from my supervisor about how to do my job.
That's the same statement again.
Strongly disagree, disagree, neutral, agree, or strongly agree?
I strongly disagree. I love getting suggestions from my supervisor.
Fine. Then let's move on to the next part of your job application. Please account for your whereabouts every day since June 1997.
And so the ages passed. Brian Davis's wife mourned for him, then moved on and married another man, who also disappeared while filling out a job form at an auto parts franchise. Everyone Brian had ever known vanished. Until one day, at long last.
All right, that's the end of part 5. Now, on to the typing test. Here is a software program that you have never encountered before and will never encounter again because it actually doesn't function well. Get on it and type this 9-page report.
All the keys are different.
Soon the sun died. The universe began receding back to its original singularity. But the labor market was still tight, so the Westridge Glove Company could just keep on doing this.
All right, part 9. Please answer the following questions, yes, no, or I don't know. First question, are you real?
I don't know.
Second question, am I real?
I don't know that either.
Next question, are you real?
Didn't you just ask that?
Did I just ask that?
I don't know.
Some say Brian is still alive somewhere, filling in information that's already on his resume. Some say there is no job. But there never was. And some say you should always send a photo with your resume, and the Times New Roman is the best font for the cover letter. But I've heard different views on that.
We're back. My next guest has done 158 Tonight shows. He guest hosted 70 times, and we're pleased he can join us now. Please welcome the recently deceased David Brenner.
Thanks, Johnny. You know, this isn't the first time I died.
I did not know that.
Yeah, the first time was at the Comedy Works in Philadelphia. I did 2 shows that night. I died twice.
That is some funny, funny stuff.
Look at you, still doing the Tonight Show in the afterlife. This must be heaven.
You wouldn't say that if you had to spend eternity next to Ed. I kid, Ed, but Ed's a f***ing bore.
I guess you can say anything here. The afterlife is like cable.
Yes, it was just bought by Comcast.
No antitrust regulations in the afterlife, sir.
Shut up, you fat turd. David, did any observations come to you while you were waiting to get into the afterlife?
Oh, sure. There's no pearly gates. It's much less impressive looking. They should call it, I don't know, Bill Gates.
That is some wild, funny stuff.
I'm sitting on a bench, and I got my Kindle under my ass, and a guy says, "Are you reading that?" And I said, "Yes." I got up, push the button to change the page, and put it back under my ass.
You know what they say, dying is easy, comedy, and breathing next to Ed is hard.
I stink, sir.
Speaking of hard, people on Earth are talking about you, Johnny.
I did not know that.
Oh, sure. They're saying your career wasn't the only thing about you that's big and long. They're saying you weren't just big, you were huge.
Ed, you want to set this dip joke up for me?
Yes! Oh, hung like a horse one.
Ed, the people are saying I was huge.
How huge was he?
You were so huge that Malaysian Airlines could hide their missing planes in your fly.
I did not get that.
Out of the loop, sir. Less hip than Jimmy Fallon. Oh, uninformed one.
At least I don't play charades with my guests. Up next, Buddy Rich, Carol Wayne, Genghis Khan, and Gary Coleman.
Hi-yo!
The final edition Radio Hour is at IHOP today to investigate a little-known gastronomic miracle, maple syrup. To help me today are two young ladies who love maple syrup, June and Jane.
Hi.
June and Jane are dressed in furry woolen items against the freezing weather, which, ironically, makes them look very hot.
Sexist. Pug.
June. Jane. We all love a stack of pancakes from IHOP slathered with maple syrup. But where does maple syrup come from?
China, McDonald's, bottles.
Nope.
Beef, corn, maple syrup well?
Nice try, but nope again. Maple syrup comes from maple trees. Maple syrup is the blood of trees.
Ew!
Maple blood is called sap. Every spring, men go out in the woods and drill holes in maple trees.
Sick. That tree is screaming right now.
Then they hammer a wooden tap into each hole to catch the sap.
They say that's what it's for. Perverts.
Excuse me, sir. What are you doing?
I'm tapping sap. I'm a sap tapper.
Liar. You fuck trails.
I've been tapping sap for 52 years. Sap tapping is crap. All it does is drip, and you don't get no respect.
No means no, you prick. I thought it's underage.
Givens, they don't want to be sap tappers. I'm dying out.
Good. Who needs you? Die soon.
Yes, young people are turning their backs on the ancient craft of tapping sap. For generations, the children of sap tappers tapped sap. Now, they're heading for the cities, looking for careers as hedge fund managers, high-end restaurateurs, and gigolos. And that's a problem. Thanks to global warming, maples are producing more sap than ever before. But if that sap isn't tapped, this happens.
Oh my god, that skeevy old pervert got the tree pregnant. Look at that baby bump. It's getting, like, huge.
End of emergency. Sap tappers can't be found. Another maple bites the dust. Amazing. The tree is vaporized. Only a shattered stump remains.
Oh my god, I'm covered with gunk. Icky, sticky, maple syrup-colored gunk. Ew!
From New England to British Columbia, forests are beginning to sound like a war zone as untapped, sap-packed maple trees go to meet their maker. The air is packed with sap. Our chopper is slathered with maple syrup. We're going down.
I'm poor now. Trees suck.
Thank you.
Coming up next on the Final Edition Radio Hour, I interview one Tony Hendra about the movie This Is Spinal Tap, its impact on satire, the world, and certain missing paychecks. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to the Final Edition Radio Hour, a more perfect onion.
And now for a special Final Edition Radio Hour interview. As most of our listeners probably know, this is the 30th anniversary of the release of the seminal film of our generation, or at least one very good movie, and that is This Is Spinal Tap. This Is Spinal Tap was a satire of the music industry, or perhaps it was more than that. We'll find out when we talk to Tony Hendra, who our listeners know as both the co-producer and co-star of the Final Edition Radio Hour, and as the man who played Sir Ian Faith, the band manager in Spinal Tap.
I don't think Ian has been knighted.
As just regular Ian Faith, a man who should have been knighted. Spinal Tap, to me, it was Spinal Tap, Monty Python, Holy Grail, and Animal House. Those are my three movies.
The Trinity.
Of my growing of comedy age, I guess it was. Although Animal House always stuck in my mind more because there was a brief boob scene. But nonetheless, those are my comedy movies.
I would say that Animal House, it does fit in that, in the Trinity,
sure,
because it is actually it got a sort of bad rap in a way because it became seen as a gross out movie with toga parties thrown in.
It became people think of it as the frat movie, much like they think of Calvin and Hobbes as Calvin pissing on things when it's deeper.
Exactly. Yes, its reputation was determined by its imitators,
mm-hmm.
And actually, it was a very potent satire of further education in the United States. I mean, with the Dean Wormer, who's essentially Nixon,
mm-hmm.
who screws around with the Constitution of Faber College, and the ROTC, which is essentially the military, and so forth and so on. So it actually, but all of that was kind of lost under the welter of food fights and toga parties.
But no, it obviously resonated for more than just a brief boob shot with me. As did Spinal Tap. I don't think there were any boob shots, but there was talk of greased up women on all fours, but
indeed,
never any shots. Spinal Tap is in a short list of movies, I won't bother pretending to remember them, that has, I think, lasted sort of the test of its time. It's been 30 years, and I think it still resonates even with people that didn't experience sort of what it was perhaps on one level speaking to, which is sort of coming out of the 60s and into the 70s and into this the 80s looming sort of corporate era of music and everything, and making fun of those types of bands, and yet people still relate to them even if they never knew any of those elements. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's actually for several reasons, but one of the reasons I'd like to discuss tonight a bit is one that isn't, I don't think, talked about very much, which is that Spinal Tap is on the sort of primary level a scathingly funny parody of the fecklessness and mindlessness of heavy metal. But on a deeper level, it seems to me, it is a satire. I mean, because it's a satire, actually, of an entire system, of the lifestyle, of its assumptions, its personnel, that helped to make the likes of Spinal Tap the cultural nadir it was. Or as one NYU cultural studies course taught by a very, very serious cultural studies professor called Andrew Ross once put it, Spinal Tap and the decline of Western civilization.
That was, now is that a cause and effect?
Well, yes, apparently, according to Andrew Ross, who is a Scot, by the way, and a very left-wing boy, left-wing Scot.
Was that, maybe you can tell me, is that because Spinal Tap finally said the emperor has no clothes and everything fell apart?
I think Spinal Tap was the meme, maybe, or the trope, or the tropey meme, or the meme trope.
The Treme.
Yeah, the Treme.
The Treme, I think that was that movie.
So, anyway, so we have the parody, obviously wonderfully carried off by the group itself, these lampoons of heavy metal's musical subgenres with all their kind of idiotic priapism. But obviously the lampoons, the parodies are brilliant, and
yeah,
they're brilliant not only because of their ridiculous sexual memes, but because of their pretension. I think it's one of the things that Spinal Tap caught wonderfully was the pretension of heavy metal. Christopher Guest's character Nigel Tufnell, who is basically the most moronic of the three morons who front Tap, is also its most moronically pretentious, with his wonderful work in progress, his trilogy in D minor, which has the working title of "Lick My Love Pump."
His pretension is what led him to the great, like, "This One Goes to 11" scene. It shattered his. He was professing such grand ambitions.
And of course, actually, Stonehenge is immensely pretentious too, mm-hmm. and it's kind of gone down in film history as an epic stage fail, but really its lyrics and effects are just as funny, because they perfectly embody that kind of awful, flaccid, Lord of the Rings-driven, Celtic, Nordic, Aryan race memory fantasies, you know, that heavy metal loves to wallow in. There's that great line, he says, "The druids, nobody knows who they were or what they were doing." it's just hilarious.
Well, it fits in also to that thing that they have earlier about having all the appealing to all the male teenagers as their audience.
Right.
I forget if that was in the scene when he had the
ocean of retarded sexuality. But the thing is that surrounding these wonderful parodies is this kind of 360 degree satire of the industry which brought us rock and fed off it, both while it was alive and well, and when it was a fly-blown corpse. And basically, no rock, if you'll forgive the expression, is left unturned during Tap's pathetic journey. And all the slimy things under each one of them are given ample room to slime themselves into movie legend. You mentioned Fran Drescher, whose character name is Bobby Fleckman, mm-hmm. and she has that wonderful sort of New York, whiny New York voice.
Perfect little publicist-ish type. I forget that was exactly her role. But
I mean, she's certainly a part of the slime monument that is Polymer Records. And then there's Sir Dennis Eaton Hogg, of course, who is founder of Hogwood, which is a summer camp for pale young boys. And even Howard Hessman. I don't know if Howard Hessman played the Terry Ladd.
He's the manager of the other band, right, that they came across? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right, in Memphis. And the star was Duke Fame. Hmm. And Duke Fame had been one of the many, many members of Spinal Tap. And what was great about that scene was that Duke Fame is equally talentless. I mean, he's just as much a sort of bottom feeder as Tap is, but he happens to be on the upswing. So Howard Hessman won't let Spinal Tap touch him, and then he sort of gets out of an awkward situation.
How are you, laddie? Great to see you, Tap. Terrific to see you,
Liam.
But I think my favorite is Paul Schaefer's Artie Fufkin, mm-hmm. of the A&R guy in Milwaukee or wherever it is. But he shows up at the record store and eventually, having tried to blame the owner of the record store for the fact that none of the public has shown up, actually blames himself in this marvelous burst of passive aggression and says,
"I'm not asking, I'm telling with this. Kick my ass."
One of the reasons why there's never been a sequel or, in fact, an effective imitation of it is that it was very much of a certain moment. And I think everybody in the movie was sort of, in some either superficial or profound way, disappointed with rock and roll. And it was that moment where you still sort of could remember caring about it enough that you were actually disappointed. It's that totality of the picture, I think, that makes the movie so interesting. Everybody in the movie contributes to that sort of world. And in that way, I think it's a satire, I mean, I would say it's a satire comparable, at least in its scope and its success, to Dr. Strangelove, which mm-hmm. has the same kind of, it totally creates a world where logic is absent, completely absent.
So we're talking about slime balls. And I gotta say, having now worked in entertainment some, if that's what I've been doing for the last million years, is your character resonates even more because you, as the band manager, have a unique sliminess that is sort of, you sort of have to tell lies to everybody in order to keep moving forward until, like, you can no longer lie anymore. When you sort of conceptualize your character, was liar part of one of the big words that drove it, or
well, no, I didn't. I mean, I didn't really think about it very much until, well, that's not quite true. I mean, I figured or modeled what I was going to do with this character on a guy called Andrew Lou Goldham, he was the manager of the Rolling Stones, and he was very much, I mean, he was sort of a blonde two-faced kind of fellow, and with a much more pucker, upper-class kind of accent than his squatting the East End of London charges.
Yeah, right.
So that seemed to me to be a fairly good model. But I must say, as soon as I started improvising, I remember it exactly. It was the scene at the beginning of the movie when they're in the limousine, and Ian is lying from the first moment he opens his mouth. He says the New York Times is going to do something, and then he says, "Well, we're not doing anything very much in New York because it's not worth it." But Philadelphia is a big rock town. It's just right from the start. He's making excuses for things before they happen.
One of the things I always thought was interesting about Ian's character is that he, like you said, he'll say, "Oh, the New York Times is going to do something," and then he undercuts it. It struck me that he was the type that would always say something good, even if a second later contradicted it. And in part, that was not just him lying, but him dealing with other characters, his charges, as you say, who are probably of the type of sociopath that only will hear the good things. That he kind of relied on being able to say, "I'm going to give you $1 million. No, I'm not." And all they heard was, "I'm going to give you $1 million," because they want to believe the best about themselves.
Right, exactly. But one of my favorite scenes, actually, is the scene where Nigel is worried about the food, the backstage food.
Oh, yeah. And
Ian is very... He's very attentive. You know, he's not lying. He's actually trying to help poor moronic Nigel fold the meat around the bread in such a way that it might be edible. But then, you know, when Nigel starts getting worked up, he says, "I don't want you to ruin your performance," you know. And he means it. Nigel's all he has, you know. And he's all Nigel has. But you're right. Ian is a slime ball, and I did it brilliantly.
What do you think about Ian's role, or other people's role in the movie, as far as like sort of the corporatism of either looming corporatism of music or just in general? Because in a way, Ian, even though he's son of a slime ball, he is management. I mean, he's their manager, so he himself sort of has a corporate element.
That's what I'm saying. I think is one of the reasons it has a kind of universal appeal, and a continuing appeal, because as you say, those slime balls are still with us and they're still screwing us and they still run the show, and the fact is that the record company hovers sort of invisibly over the whole movie. It's not just in the occasional characters that show up from the record industry. I mean, and often Ian's job is simply to be the messenger of that. I mean, when he produces the Black Album, which doesn't even have their name on it, you know, and tries to enthuse about it, we're finally on our way, you know.
There is sort of this element of the corporation or the record company as God. Like, it's sort of, Ian is struggling there, having to lie, but there's a sense that if the company really wanted to get behind it, they can make a star. I mean,
they could make it into Duke fame overnight if they wanted to.
Right, yeah. And yet that doesn't happen. And
right. I go back to this, the idea that you've just expressed, because it came out like in the height of the Reagan years, right? I mean, it came out in 1984 when sort of Unchained Capitalism and Greed is Good, you know, was really roaring, and the corporations had sort of almost overnight, from being the villains of the piece in the 60s and 70s, were now the heroes. But I think this might be one of the reasons, if I'm right, this might be one of the reasons why, and I can reveal this now on our show.
Reveal it.
That the principles of this incredibly successful movie, I mean, one thing you can say about it is that it's not only been pretty successful all over the English-speaking world, and indeed in parts of the non-English-speaking world, like Germany and France, all the money that presumably has been taken in by somebody, in fact by a number of corporations, more than half a dozen actually, over the 30 years, not one cent of that has been enjoyed by the principals of the movie. No profit participation, although all of us had contracts guaranteeing profit participation. Not one cent of that has been seen. So they got their revenge, the corporation.
That's kind of amazing. And you did have contracts that said you get back. I mean, I know, look, Hollywood reporting, quote-unquote, is making sure that every expense just goes in lockstep with every piece of income. But that's kind of ridiculous.
The budget for this movie?
It was, what, like $12? I mean,
$4 million. Okay. Right. $4 million. It's probably one of the lowest budget massive hit movies ever. And if... There comes a point where if a movie costs $4 million and it continues to
for
make 30 money
for 30 years,
there's going to be some profit there somewhere.
I do have a law degree, and I'm a member of the California Bar, but I don't think I'm going to be the best guy to
I think we ought to go on as a sort of poor little Spinal Tap, you know, and go on Kickstarter and see if we can get enough money to really slap them. That's
well, would you raise money to fund a lawsuit, or would you just raise money to pay yourselves?
Because that's right. Why give it to the middleman? Yeah. Just don't call me Liam.
That was Tony Hendra, who played Sir Ian. I keep saying Sir Ian. I want you to be a sir. Ian Faith in Spinal Tap, or This Is Spinal Tap, with not just some interesting artistic and creative insights, but also a legal bombshell.
Stay tuned for more of the Final Edition Radio Hour, in which we visit with This Week in Canada, always 2 weeks behind the rest of the world, eh? And an exclusive interview with legendary inventor of the World Wide Web, Sir Timothy Berners-Lee, in which our Stonepeck asks Sir Tim a few very pointed questions.
Welcome back to the conclusion of the Final Edition Radio Hour, A More Perfect Onion. It looks like we might make it after all.
I'm a salesman, and I'm on the road constantly, and I'm sick to death of my boss calling at all hours of the day and night to check up on me. I was so stressed out that I felt like throwing my cell phone off the Golden Gate Bridge. So I did.
With the AT&T landline, your boss will have no idea where you are.
My AT&T landline sits on the desk in my office, but I'm never in my office.
Why didn't somebody think of this before?
The AT&T landline offers you something totally new. Freedom! A convenient answering machine records all the messages your boss wants to leave, while it leaves you alone to take care of business, no matter where you are.
When I'm out on business, what I'm doing is nobody's business.
AT&T Landline. It's your lifeline.
To This Week in Canada, eh? 2 weeks behind the rest of the world. What's that all about? My guests tonight are Geddy Lee, Gilda Radner, Neil Young, and Kiefer Sutherland's grandfather. Anybody know what happened in Canada this week? Giddy?
Today's oil production, real, real rude. Today's tall sands, mean, mean, crude.
Gilda.
What's all this fuss I hear about Alberta Tarzan devastation? Tarzan doesn't even come from Alberta. He comes from Africa. And even if he did come from Alberta, he's fictional. Who cares what kind of devastation comes from a fictional man who runs around in a loincloth? And furthermore...
excuse me, Miss Latella.
Yes?
That's Alberta Tar Sands Devastation. Not Alberta Tarzan Devastation.
Oh, that's completely different. Never mind.
Don't worry about it.
Bitch.
What do you think about Alberta Tar Sands Devastation, Neil Young?
Oh, toxic sludge in the tar sand soon will infect all of our glands. Rich enough now, you scum oil man, with so many of you, don't you understand? It's the shithead in you that makes you wanna rape this land.
I have something to say about Alberta Tar Sands.
Yes, Kiefer Sutherland's grandfather.
My grandson, Kiefer Sutherland, is rebooting 24.
What does that have to do with Tar Sands devastation?
Well, not that much. But, like Canada, after the Tar Sands devastation, I got nothing.
Does anybody have anything? Gilda.
It's like my father used to say, it's always something. One minute, you got a little green booger hanging by a disgusting little thread out the side of your left nostril. And the next minute, you got a toxic tar sand oil sludge spill coming out of the Keystone XL pipeline that makes you want to die.
That's all we have time for, eh? Join us next time when we'll ask Canadian Olympic biggest skater Tessa Virtue what her vices are all about.
Twenty-5 years ago, last Friday, Sir Timothy Berners-Lee wrote a proposal for a global hypertext system, which became the World Wide Web. All this month, he's been making tech headlines by deploring the mass surveillance of the Internet by the NSA and Britain's GCHQ. It threatens the open web, says Sir Tim. We need an Internet Bill of Rights. Our Stone Pack caught up with the living legend at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Sir Timothy, a few questions.
I've got one. Sir Tim, did you invent the World Wide Web? Yes, I did! Ha ha!
Well, let's just...
Golly, you know, it's just occurred to me that MIT is an anadrome of Tim. How ridiculously serendipitous is that?
Come on, Sir Tim, you've been at MIT for what, 20 years, and it's just occurred to you that it's Tim backwards?
Oh, yes, my head's in the clouds 24-7. I'm just a geek at heart. I love big ideas, big data, universal concepts.
Right. And what you invented 25 years ago was a universal language, which linked billions of pages, enabling billions of individuals to use the Internet for their own individual purposes.
In effect, creating an entirely new society built on the Internet.
Indeed. The World Wide Web needed the Internet, a worldwide network of computer networks to exist, correct?
Correctissimo.
But you didn't invent the Internet.
No. I merely saw its potential to connect and liberate every single person in the whole wide...
Actually, the U.S. military invented the Internet.
20th century history 101. Full marks. The U.S. military's Advanced Research Projects Agency, ARPA, built the ARPANET in the late 60s, the very first network of independent computer networks. It became the Internet, designed primarily for military purposes. But it took a visionary, well, a geek, or rather a mega-geek, a visionary mega-geek, in a word, me, to see beyond these nasty, narrow, probably violent, original purposes.
Some of our listeners may not know that the Internet was invented by the military.
True. But that really doesn't matter when you consider the fabulous success of the World Wide Web. You know, I've watched over the web like a loving, well, not father, that would be sexist, let's say loving aunt. Through its carefree childhood, its turbulent teens, its first kiss, its hormone-related skin issues, the bulimia, its feelings of alienation and suicidal thoughts, its first one-night stand, its high school graduation, at which, of course, it was the valedictorian, and its first really bad hangover.
And now, at age 25, it's confronted with corporate assaults on net neutrality. Internet giants like mining vast amounts of data about people's personal habits, and...
This illegal, immoral snooping on hundreds of millions of people by the military. This is why the Internet needs a Bill of Rights. This has to stop. Military intelligence gathering is the most outrageous corruption of the goals of the World Wide Web ever.
But Sir Tim, what did you expect? You adapted a technology developed by and for the military. Did you think the military would just hand it over and start blogging about the crazy things Mittens the Kitten did today?
The military doesn't own the World Wide Web. I, Sir Tim Berners-Lee, gave it gratis to the whole human race.
But didn't you consider the risks of essentially hitching a ride on a military technology?
No. I adopted the military's technology for a higher purpose. One of my chief goals was to make the military obsolete, go away, by connecting everyone on Earth, eliminating those tragic conflicts and misunderstandings that lead to war, and therefore the need for the military.
But Sir Tim, the military never goes away. The military's like death and taxes. It's always with us.
Ha ha, yes. The military is all about death and taxes, isn't it? Very good. They take our tax money and they kill people with it. Very astute. But they have been swept away by our Internet.
No, they haven't. It's their Internet. And they're using the vast web of people you connected to find out more and more about people than they ever dreamt of. You did their work for them. They began these so-called intelligence programs at exactly the same time, the early 90s, that you invented the World Wide Web. You gave that angry jihadist the means to link to Al-Qaeda's webpage and become an actual terrorist. And you gave the military the means to track him.
That is the most obscene, obtuse, distorted, deluded, decadent, reductionist view of the most important advance in human communication since the discovery of fire. Everything will sort itself out as long as the web remains free and open and the property of all.
Well, so long as it does, the military will be able to exploit it to their heart's content. So it will never be open again. You can't have it both ways.
Yes, I can. Having it both ways is the essence of the World Wide Web. I created a new way of life where the old ways do not apply. The world will never be the same.
Oh, you're right, it won't. GCHQ now has a program called Optic Nerve. They capture webcam images of millions of Yahoo users in their own homes and store them in a vast database. They have eyes into the private lives of every person with a computer. Chapter 1 of 1984. Big Brother is now actually watching you. Not a metaphor, not a bad dream.
I, Sir Timothy Berners-Lee, who invented, it cannot be said often enough, the World Wide Web, hereby declare everything will sort itself out as long as the web remains free and open and the property of all.
When you wish upon a star, make no difference who you are. Anything your heart desires will come.
I don't want to text, okay? I have no interest in it. I wish they made a phone you can't text on.
If you don't want to text, the AT&T landline is the phone for you. It has no text capability. In fact, aside from dialing, the only things you can do with the AT&T landline are talk and listen.
Finally, there's a phone that doesn't do what I don't want a phone to do.
Think of the hours you'll save not sending or receiving texts from friends or family.
And I hate realizing I've spent the last 10 minutes yakking to nobody. I feel like an idiot.
With the AT&T landline, there are no dropped calls, no dead zones, not once, not ever.
I guess it's that cord that does it. But I don't care how it works. I just know it works. I'm going to go home now and see if anybody called.
The AT&T landline. It's your lifeline. And coming soon from AT&T... public telephones in booths.
The Final Edition Radio Hour East was performed by Jeff Chrysler, Jen Dodd, Rob Gordon, John Marshall, Darby Worley, Kevin Janis, and Tony Hindra. The Final Edition Radio Hour West by Jeff Hendrick, Ebby Parker, Barry Link, Jim Earle, and Steve Rosenfield, with music by Kevin McLeod of Incompetech.com. It was written by Barry Lank, Jeff Chrysler, Jim Earle, John Marshall, Steve Rosenfield, and Tony Hindra. The Final Edition Radio Hour was edited by Andrew Hammond and Greg Russ and produced by Tony Hindra and Jeff Chrysler. West Coast production by Barry Lank. This has been a production of The Final Edition, LLC, copyright 2014.